The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, this is from the Ideas section, and this is definitely an opinion piece. This is a little more political than articles that I typically choose. I hope you will enjoy it. I thought it was a bit fascinating. This is entitled, "The West Must Defeat Russia," by Ann Applebaum, one of the staff writers. They plan to take Kyiv in 3 days, the rest of Ukraine in 6 weeks. More than 21 months later, Russian forces have withdrawn from half the territory they occupied in February of last year. At least 88,000 Russian soldiers are likely dead, a conservative estimate, and at least twice as many have been wounded. Billions of dollars worth of equipment, Russian tanks, planes, artillery, helicopters, armored vehicles, and warships have been destroyed. If you had predicted this outcome before the war, and nobody did, it would have seemed fanciful. No one would have believed that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, a professional comedian, would lead a country that a democratic world would be united enough to help him, or that Russian President Vladimir Putin would endure such humiliation. Ukraine, the United States, and the European Union have achieved something remarkable. Working together, they have not only preserved the Ukrainian state, but stood up to a bully whose nihilism harms the entire world. Putin backs far-right and extremist movements in Europe, provides thugs to support African dictatorships, and colludes with China, Iran, Venezuela, and other autocracies. From the beginning, Putin hoped the war would demonstrate that American power and American alliances can be defeated, not only in Ukraine, but everywhere else. He still does, and for this purpose, the war remains useful to him. The fighting creates food shortages in Africa, thereby generating more unrest and more demand for Russian mercenaries. The war strokes discontent in Europe as well, giving pro-Russian parties a boost. Americans and Europeans view turmoil in country after country as a series of isolated conflicts, but Putin doesn't think that Ukraine and the Middle East belong to different competing spheres. On the contrary, since the conflict in Gaza erupted, he has intensified his relationship with Iran, invited leaders of Hamas to Moscow, and attacked Israel because of its links to the U.S., hoping that the spread of violence will decrease Western support for Ukraine. Iranian drones have terrorized Ukrainian cities. Iran, in turn, distributes Russian weapons to its proxies. Hezbollah is thought to have Russian anti-ship missiles that it could use against U.S. warships in the Mediterranean at any time. The Allied fight against Russia in Ukraine has damaged Russia's ability to project negative power in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. But despite his extraordinary losses, Putin still believes that time is on his side. If he can't win on the battlefield, he will still win using political intrigue and economic pressure. He will wait for the democratic world to splinter, and he will encourage that splintering. He will wait for the Ukrainians to grow tired, and he will try to make that happen, too. He will wait for Donald Trump to win the 2024 U.S. presidential election, and he will do anything he can to help that happen, too. Right now, Putin's bets are on the Republicans who repeat Russian propaganda. Senator J.D. Vance, for example, echoes Russian language about the Ukraine war, leading to global disorder and escalation. Representative Matt Gaetz cited a Chinese state media source as evidence while asking about alleged Ukrainian neo-Nazis at a congressional hearing. Vivek Ramaswamy, a GOP presidential candidate, has also called Zelensky, who is Jewish, a Nazi. Putin will have been cheered by the new House Speaker, Mike Johnson, who is knowingly delaying the military and financial aid that Ukraine needs to keep fighting. The supplemental bill that he refuses to pass includes money that will keep Ukrainians supplied with the air defense systems they need to protect their cities, as well as the fiscal support they need to sustain their economy and crucial infrastructure in the coming months. The U.S. is supplying about a third of Ukraine's financial needs. The rest comes from the European Union, global institutions, and the taxes paid and bonds purchases by Ukrainians themselves. But without that help, Ukraine will have trouble surviving the winter. Part of the Republican resistance to helping Ukraine fight an American adversary is simply the perverse desire to see President Joe Biden fail. Another part comes from the fear that Ukraine is not able to win. The Ukrainian summer counteroffensive did have some success, especially in the Black Sea, where a combination of drones and missiles has badly weakened Russia's navy and forced some of its ships to leave the Crimean port of Sebastopol. But the progress on land was slow. Ukrainians' ability to inflict huge casualties on Russia was not enough to create a backlash or a reconsideration in Moscow. General Valery Zaluzhny, the Ukrainian commander-in-chief, has recently spoken of the war as a stalemate. Although Zaluzhny has also described in detail the technology he needs to move his army forward and break that stalemate, his statement has renewed talk in the West of a truce or a ceasefire. Some are calling for a ceasefire in bad faith. In fact, they want a Russian victory, or at least a defeat for Biden. Others, however, advocate a truce with the best of intentions. They believe that because Putin will never give up, the damage to Ukraine must be limited. Lately, I've heard several well-meaning people, all supporters of Ukraine, argue that this conflict could end the way the Korean War once ended, with the borders frozen on the current front line and the rest of the Ukraine, like South Korea, protected by a U.S. security guarantee or even U.S. bases. All of these suggestions, well-meaning or otherwise, have the same flaw. A ceasefire, temporary or otherwise, means that both sides have to stop fighting. Right now, even if Zelensky agrees to negotiate, there is no evidence that Putin wants to negotiate, that he wants to stop fighting, or that he has ever wanted to stop fighting. And yes, according to Western officials who have periodic conversations with their Russian counterparts, attempts have been made to find out. Nor is there any evidence that Putin wants to partition Ukraine, keeping only the territories he currently occupies and allowing the rest to prosper like South Korea. His goal remains the destruction of Ukraine, all of Ukraine, and his allies and propagandists are still talking about how, once they achieve this goal, they will expand their empire further. Just last week, Dmitry Medvedev, Russia's former president, published an 8,000-word article calling Poland Russia's historical enemy and threatening Poles with the loss of their state, too. The message was perfectly clear. We invaded Poland before, and we can do it again. In this sense, the challenge that Putin represents to Europe and the rest of the world is unchanged from February of 2022. If we abandon what we have achieved so far and we give up support for Ukraine, the result could still be the military or political conquest of Ukraine. The conquest of Ukraine could still empower Iran, Venezuela, Syria, and the rest of Putin's allies. It could still encourage China to invade Taiwan. It could still lead to a new kind of Europe, one in which Poland, the Baltic states, and even Germany are under constant physical threat, with all of the attendant consequences for trade and prosperity. A Europe permanently at war, an idea that seems impossible to most people in the West, still seems eminently plausible to the Russian president. Putin spent a memorable part of his life as a KGB officer, representing the interests of the Soviet Empire in Dresden. He remembers when Eastern Germany was ruled by Moscow. If it could be so once, then why not again? The stark truth is that this war will only end for good when Russia's neo-imperial dream finally dies. Just as the French decided in 1962 that Algeria could become independent of France, just as the British accepted in 1921 that Ireland was no longer part of the United Kingdom, the Russians must conclude that Ukraine is not Russia. I can't tell you which political changes in Moscow are necessary to achieve that goal. I can't say whether a different Russian leader is required, maybe or maybe not. But we will recognize this change when it happens. After it does, the conflict is over and negotiating a final settlement will be possible. To reach that end game, we need to adjust our thinking. First, we need to understand more deeply than we have done so far that we have entered a new era of great power conflict. The Russians already know this and have already made the transition to a full-scale war economy. 40% of the Russian state budget, another conservative estimate, is now spent annually on military production, about 10% of GDP, a level not seen for decades. Neither the U.S. nor its European allies have made anything like this shift, and we started from a low base. Jack Watling of the Royal United Services Institute told me that, at the beginning of the war, the ammunition that the United Kingdom produced in a year was enough to supply the Ukrainian army for 20 hours. Although the situation has improved, as production has slowly cranked up all over the democratic world, we are not moving fast enough. Secondly, we need to start helping the Ukrainians fight this war as if we were fighting it, altering our slow decision-making process to match the urgency of the moment. Ukraine received the weapons for its summer fighting very late, giving the Russians time to build minefields and tank traps. Why? Training by NATO forces for Ukrainian soldiers has in some cases been rushed and incomplete. Why? There is still time to reverse these mistakes. Zaluzhny's list of breakthrough technologies, which includes tools to gain air superiority and better wage electronic warfare, should be taken seriously now and not next year. But the path to end this war does not only lead through the battlefield. We need to start thinking not just about helping Ukraine, but about defeating Russia, or if you prefer different language, persuading Russia to leave by any means possible. If Russia is already fighting America and America's allies on multiple fronts through political funding, influence campaigns, and its links to other autocracies and terrorist organizations, then the U.S. and Europe need to fight back on multiple fronts too. We should outcompete Russia for the scarce commodities needed to build weapons, block the software updates that they need to run their defense factories, look for ways to sabotage their production facilities. Russia used fewer weapons and less ammunition this year than it did last year. Our task should be to ensure that next year is worse. The West has already sanctioned Russia and put export controls on electronics and many other components necessary for the Russian defense ministry. Paradoxically, there may now be too many of these sanctions, which are difficult to keep track of in force, especially when materials go through third and fourth countries. Instead, we should target the most important supply chains, depriving the Russians of the specific machine tools and raw materials that they need to make the most sophisticated weapons. At the start of the war, the U.S. and its allies froze Russia's foreign currency deposits. The assets of many Russian oligarchs were frozen too, in the hope that this would make them more inclined to resist the war. With some exceptions, it did not. Now it's time to take those assets and give them to Ukraine. We need to demonstrate that our commitment to the principle of Russian reparations for Ukraine is real. But some of our money is needed too. Spending it now will produce savings down the line, and not just because we can prevent a catastrophe in Ukraine. By learning how to fight Russia, a sophisticated autocracy with global ambitions, we will be better prepared for later, larger conflicts, if there ever is a broader struggle with China or Iran. More important, by defeating Russia, we might be able to stop those larger conflicts before they begin. The goal in Ukraine should be to end Russia's brutish invasion and to deter others from launching another one somewhere else. Our next article, also from the Ideas section, The False Binary in Higher Ed, by Ben Wildavsky. For much of the past century, America believed that college was essential to upward mobility. A four-year degree has long been the symbol of the American dream, seen as a way to ensure that millions of students could be better off than their parents and grandparents. Today, however, that faith is plummeting. A Gallup poll earlier this year found that Americans' confidence in higher education has fallen to a new low of 36%, down from 57% in 2015. Although a record share of Americans had a bachelor's degree as of 2021, degree skepticism and pandemic-related disruptions led undergraduate enrollment to drop 8% from 2019 to 2022. This pessimism is understandable. The earnings advantage afforded by a bachelor's degree, although still sizable, has leveled off in the past 15 years, while tuition has continued to rise. And according to the National Student Clearinghouse, 40 million Americans have enrolled in college, but haven't ultimately graduated, an all-time high. As a result, college has left many students in debt, without a degree to help them get out of it. In response, many Americans have adopted an either-or approach to higher education, one that pits abstract academics against career preparation. Some prospective students are giving up on traditional degrees altogether, favoring instead cheaper, shorter, career-focused credentials. This fall, for example, a Clearinghouse analysis found that enrollments in non-degree certificate programs rose nearly 10% compared with last year. But the push to replace a liberal education with practical training is deeply misguided. The two approaches are complements, not substitutes. The best careers require both. Perhaps that's why practical education already pervades the college system. And when the push extends to economically disadvantaged students who are disproportionately steered toward non-degree programs that don't have strong records of fostering economic and career advancement, it's particularly dangerous. Despite the claims that the degree is dead, the job market itself is sending an unambiguous signal. College is still worth it. Places like Colorado Mountain College demonstrate why. CMC is one of about 400 dual-mission institutions in the U.S. that offer a mix of undergraduate programs and specialized certificates. Students have a wide range of choices, such as an associate degree in English literature, a bachelor's degree designed for forest managers, or a certification in avalanche science. We want learners who come out of CMC to know how to think. Carrie Besnett Hauser, the school's president, told me, "We do liberal arts and career-focused skills training and smash them together." The graduates who are most valuable to employers have both targeted, profession-specific skills and the kind of transferable skills, such as writing, critical thinking, and communication, that are honed by a liberal education. Consider the local tourism industry that employs many CMC graduates. An outdoor guide should be able to work with spreadsheets, communicate with clients, and market the enterprise. A fly fishing instructor who wants to start a business will likely need to understand not only sales and accounting, but also environmental science. In addition to the dual mission schools like CMC, America has more than 100 land-grant institutions which were established to provide professional skills in the context of a liberal education. Undergraduates at these schools can specialize in areas such as forensic, hotel management, and agricultural science while also being exposed to a broad range of academic subjects. The job market rewards this combination. Using a database of hundreds of millions of online job postings, resumes, and social profiles, the labor market and analytics company Burning Glass Technologies has documented the rise of hybrid jobs, which demand a blend of technical skills and creative thinking. The company showed that hybrid jobs pay more than those that require a narrower set of skills. They are the jobs that are growing the fastest, that are of the highest value. Matt Siegelman, the chairman and one of the authors of the report, told me, "That's why liberal arts degrees, according to Siegelman, have twice as much value when combined with some specific technical skills." For this reason, the Harvard University economist David Deming argues against what he described as the impulse to make college curriculums ever more technical and career-focused. He makes the case that even the early career earnings advantage of college graduates in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fades steadily after their first post-college jobs, while liberal arts majors gradually catch up by middle age. Technical skills might garner a short-term salary premium, but they become obsolete over time and require refreshing. Meanwhile, Deming adds, liberal arts soft skills such as problem-solving and adaptability have long-term career value. Deming envisions a world, he told me, where more and more people are getting a four-year degree and then also going to a coding boot camp or to get a certificate in some specialized trade. That won't be possible for everyone, but many schools affordably offer both paths. Some employers have begun to emphasize skills over degrees in their job listings, but hiring trends suggest that that degrees are still king. A recent LinkedIn analysis found that many job listings on the site have dropped degree requirements. This shift, however, hasn't translated into more jobs for workers without degrees. Beyond employability, degree programs offer another key benefit, social capital. College can be an excellent environment for people to build, assess, and mobilize professional networks. That's particularly important for first-generation students who don't have inherited networks. Some colleges have found effective ways to give disadvantaged students extra help building social capital by following internship guidance, regularly inviting industry leaders, hosting networking events, and providing career coaching to teach students how to leverage connections. Degree alternatives still have a place for in-demand fields, health specialties, for instance, or data science. Specialized certificates allow students to improve their employment prospects quickly and cheaply. A growing number of employers, Amazon and Walmart among them, are subsidizing short-term credentials for their employees in recognition that educational opportunities retain workers in a tight labor market. When those short-term credentials can be stacked together into degrees, so much the better. Traditional degrees are not right for everyone, and our growing skepticism is a sure sign that colleges must become accessible to more Americans. But much of that skepticism is unfounded and dangerous. If we continue to ignore the unique value of a college degree, we'll discourage students from pursuing the education that can best help them and the country to get ahead. Next, Why Americans Can't Accept the Good Economic News, by James Surowiecki. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? That question, first posed by Ronald Reagan in a 1980 presidential campaign debate with Jimmy Carter, has become the quintessential political question about the economy. And most Americans today, it seems, would say their answer is no. In a new survey by Bankrate, published on Wednesday of this week, only 21% of those surveyed said their financial situation had improved since Joe Biden was elected president in 2020, against 50% who said it had gotten worse. That echoed the results of an ABC News Washington Post poll from September, in which 44% of those surveyed said they were worse off financially since Biden's election. As has been much commented on, this gloom is striking when contrasted with the actual performance of the U.S. economy, which grew at an annual rate of 4.9% in the most recent quarter, and which has seen unemployment holding below 4% for more than 18 months. But the downbeat mood is perhaps more striking when contrasted with the picture offered by the Federal Reserve's recently released survey of consumer finances. The survey provides an in-depth analysis of financial condition of American households conducted for the Fed by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. The latest survey looked at Americans' net worth as of mid to late 2022 and Americans' income in 2021, comparing them with equivalent data from 3 years earlier. It found that despite the severe disruption to the economy caused by the pandemic and the recovery from it, Americans across the spectrum saw their incomes and wealth rise over the survey period. The rise in median income net worth was the most notable improvement. It jumped 37% from 2019 to 2022. Americans in every income bracket saw substantial gains, with the biggest gains registered by people in the middle and upper middle brackets, which suggests that a slight narrowing of wealth inequality occurred during this time. In particular, Black and Latino households saw their median net worth rise faster than white households did, though the racial wealth gap is so wide that it narrowed only slightly as a result of this change. Americans have also reduced their debt loads during the pandemic. The median credit card balance dropped by 14%, and the share of people with car loans fell. More significantly still, Americans' median debt-to-asset, debt-to-income, and debt-payment-to-income ratios all fell, meaning that U.S. households had lower debt burdens on average in 2022 than they had had 3 years earlier. The picture the survey paints, then, is one of American households not only weathering the pandemic in surprisingly good shape, but ultimately also emerging from it in better financial shape than they were going in. And that, in turn, points to the effect of the U.S. policy response to the crisis. Stimulus payments, enhanced unemployment benefits, the child care tax credit, and the moratorium on student loan payments boosted household income and balance sheets, helping people pay down their debt, increase their savings. In the process, these policies mildly narrowed inequality. The U.S. government's aggressive response to the pandemic, including stimulus spending, also helped the job market recover from its pandemic-related losses and add millions of jobs on top. The resulting tight labor market has been a huge boon to lower-wage workers. In fact, because the Fed survey's income data end in 2021, it understates the income gains for the bottom half of the workforce and shrinking income inequality that they've produced. Hourly wages for production and non-supervisory workers rose 4.4% year-on-year in the third quarter of 2023, ahead of the pace of inflation. So what should we take from the surveys? Not that everything is fine, but the public policy and macroeconomic management matter a lot. Enhanced unemployment benefits, the child care tax credit, and stimulus payments, these things materially improve the lives of Americans and help set the economy up for a strong recovery. If the policy response had been less aggressive, the U.S. economy would be in worse shape now. This is something you can see by looking at Europe, where economies are growing far more slowly and unemployment is higher, while inflation is no lower. So allowing for the high inflation we saw in 2022, no one could really look at the U.S. economy today and say that the policy choices of the past 3 years made us poorer. Yet that, of course, is precisely how many Americans feel. Although that pessimism does not bode well for Biden's reelection prospects, the real problem with it is even more far-reaching. If voters think that policies that help them actually hurt them, that makes it much less likely that politicians will embrace similar policies in the future. The U.S. got a lot right in its macroeconomic approach over the past 3 years. Too bad that voters think it got so much wrong. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.